Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are super excited and a little bit starstruck by today's guest. We're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. That's right. Today we are interviewing the one, the only, Cat Casey. We've got a cat in the hen house. And just for all those that are listening, I do need to confirm that she is totally blinged out in her pink sequins.
So. Yes.
I do also have the techno cat in neon behind me. So just I'm setting the stage.
Smart. We love. Well, and though she needs no introduction, we're going to do one anyway. So Kat is an absolute force of nature in the world of legal tech. As the chief growth officer at Reveal, she's redefining the intersection of AI and e-discovery, helping legal teams harness cutting-edge tools to solve complex legal challenges. She's known for her bold insights, high energy, and passion for innovation. And Kat is a very sought-after speaker, podcaster, and thought leader who's been a vocal advocate for making legal tech more accessible, more efficient, and more human. Over her career, Kat has held several senior roles at top global service providers and has worked closely with law firms, corporate legal teams, and government agencies. So the trifecta, if you will. She brings deep expertise in forensic tech, data analytics, and legal strategy, and an uncanny ability to translate the technical into the practical. So whether she's keynoting conferences, hosting her podcast, The Data-Driven Realist, or championing the next generation of legal professionals, Kat's mission is clear: empower the legal world to embrace transformation with clarity and confidence. And so without further ado, welcome, Kat. We are thrilled to have you and all of your pink sequined techno cat glory.
Oh, I love it. One small tweak. The podcast is the Techno Cat, where I give data-driven insights so close. But you know what? No worries. No, it's gold. Honestly, I love that because it explains what the Techno Cat is. Otherwise, people don't know what the heck it is. So,
do you know what's funny? As I was reading that, I was like, this isn't correct, or am I just wrong in my head?
Sometimes hallucinations happen with organic computers, and it's okay.
Welcome to the pod.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. With an introduction like that at my cheeks, you can't tell, but they're like under the blush. I'm blushing because you guys are so wonderful. I'm always just like, I'm Kat. I talk about AI and rush on to the next thing.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us. We do feel pretty honored that in your busy schedule with all the people that are demanding your attention that you wanted to spend some time with us. So thank you for being here. And, you know, before we get started on our topic, which is all about Kat, the cat in the hen house, I did want to ask you guys a little icebreaker question. So we're in the middle of summertime right now, which for me means that I'm sweating my booty off in Houston, trying to stay in the air conditioned as much as humanly possible. But I'm curious for you ladies, and I'll start with you, Kat, since you're our guest. I'm curious what your favorite summertime activities are.
I love escaping the heat, actually. I'm Texas too. I'm in Austin. So I just got back from, I was up in Angel Fire in the mountains hiking. And I don't seem very outdoorsy because I'm not, but anything that gets me below 115 degrees makes me real happy. Otherwise, boating, traveling, just spending time with my friends, because during conference season, I'm go, go, go everywhere. And it's kind of nice to have a 6-week reprieve where I can be like, so people that live near me, how you doing?
I can imagine. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, I've been gone a lot this year as well. I think I've had like 15 trips already this year. And I mean, you probably double up on that. It's like, I feel like I can't stay connected to people. So yeah, I can imagine you. That's an important time of your summer. How about you, Angie?
Well, I want to pause really quick on this 115 degree threshold. That's the ceiling for you?
Oh, no. Anything over 100 and I'm a grumpy cat, like literally the most unhappy. But it actually hasn't been crazy hot this year. But some years we'll have like Houston and Austin both like 60, 70 days over 100. And like anything over 100 is miserable.
Oh, my God. I'm such a Pacific Northwest girly. I'm like anything over 80. And I'm just like,
you're spoiled.
The horror. I can't do it. I absolutely can't do it. But yeah, 90, 100, it's like, oh, okay. So do I just live inside a hairdryer at this point?
Inside an HVAC, inside of air conditioning. So it's usually 72, yeah. But I do miss, like, I get a little seasonal affectiveness disorder because I'm not getting vitamin D.
I know.
Hide inside.
I know. We've had a lot of rain lately. Y'all probably have too, Kat. And so Like my favorite summertime activity is always to go to our pool. We have a neighborhood pool and like all the kids like to play and the adults get to have like their time without the children. but I haven't been able to go because it's been raining and I look very pale and I'm not very happy about that.
No. I was paler, I'd be translucent. I feel you. My pigmentation is in the form of freckles.
Well, I usually switch up my base or my foundation during the summer. It's like, oh, I go darker. And this year I'm like, no, pretty much the same pasty white girl.
I'm an indoor creature this year.
Yeah. Okay.
Definitely an inside cat this year.
Oh, my God. Well, it's better than me. So one of my favorite summertime activities is honestly, we live sort of like on top of a hill and you run down to the bottom, you're at the beach. And so I love running along the beach and there's like a view of downtown. There's a view of the mountains.
You're making me hate you. Just stop.
But I have the weirdest tan lines from doing so much running. So my face, like I usually like wear a hat or sunscreen or something. So like my face isn't getting very tan, but like my arms are, but it's like sort of weird straps and stuff. Like, so my tan line is just all kinds of jacked up right now.
Love it.
I would like to feel sorry for you, but I don't. So
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. Yeah.
Well, the whole purpose of us wanting to hang out with you, Kat, just because we want to be cool and hang with the cool kids. The cool cats. Yeah, that's right. Beyond that, though, let me just back up. The purpose of our podcast is really to make e-discovery and legal tech approachable. We want to be a resource for people who are wanting to get into the industry or who are at a very specialized portion of the industry and want to kind of branch out and understand what e-discovery is all about. So one of the reasons, other than being with the cool cat, that we wanted you to be here today is that we know that you've been uber successful in your own career. And you certainly, like Angie was introducing you a moment ago, you've been around, you've seen a lot of different perspectives in our career, in our industry anyway. So we want to hear more about you, your experience, your life, your advice that you might give to people. So that is kind of the theme of today's podcast. So I'll start from the very beginning. What did pull you into the e-discovery world to begin with? And I say this like holding my breath because there's nobody that like, oh, I went to college for e-discovery and then I went right into the field.
So my decision started when I was 12, right? Because all great, brilliant decisions happen when you're in whatever, sixth grade. And I remember I was on a swing set and I was the kid that was like two grades ahead in math. And so they would give me like the pre-cal book and say, go out on the picnic table, good luck. But I was also good at writing and like just words. And I'm like, well, if I do the math thing, I have to be a doctor because you're very binary when you're that age. If I do the word thing, I can be a lawyer. If I mess up as a doctor, they're dead. As a lawyer, I can appeal. That was my entire thought process. So from then on, I kind of pivoted away from STEM. I went and I did undergrad, studied philosophy and government, finished at like 20. I couldn't even drink yet, went right into law school. And then by the time I was in law school, I was like, wow, I'm great at this transactional stuff and I hate it. I don't want to do it. So when I was done with law school, I didn't practice. I took a beat and I was like, I don't know what I want to be when I grow up. And my dad had done really complicated government sales. Like he sold the B-2 bomber to the U.S. government, defense contracting stuff. And I'm like, well, maybe I could do sales. Well, I don't think I've ever done that before. Before I'd only ever been a grocery bagger at HEB. Let me try it out. But what's the grossest type of sales to see if I have the stomach for it? Definitely cars. But if I'm going to do cars, I want it to be fancy and the best place I could be. So briefly selling BMWs in Orange County. And I became the top grossing sales girl within 3 months. I sold this M5 for like $40,000 over a sticker to someone. And I happened to sell it to someone in the legal technology industry.
Wow.
Fruited out at 23. And basically I talked with him as I'm signing a $150,000 contract for a car. He's like, you should be doing legal tech. And so I came in on the people side, and that was at 23. My first boss, I won't name her, but she did tell me I had to lie and say I was 30 because I was managing a bunch of recruiters who were 50. I was like, I lied down or up by 7 years. Does that mean I can lie down by seven?
Like, yeah.
Yeah. So I got recruited out at 23 by an exec, and it was, I just found my home base. And even though I was on the staffing side, so I was doing like Howery Intel, where there were like 500 attorneys in a basement in Falls Church, I figured out pretty quickly that because I grew up understanding tech, my grandfather helped create virtual memory. We had laptops in my house from the age of 7 or 8 on. Because I could talk tech to the lawyers, but I had a legal background, but I also had a sales background, it kind of was this perfect storm. And I became, by accident on the staffing side, an expert on tech, on machine learning. I befriended Andy Peck. He was sending me to Silva Moore before it was published. And this weird vortex back in 06, 07, like when everything was brand spanking new in eDiscovery, kind of sucked me in and I haven't been able to escape.
Wow. That's very fascinating about your family, too. I didn't realize that you have generations of folks in your background that kind of lent to your own success and your own skills. So what drives your passion? I mean, now we know how you got into the business to begin with, but what keeps you passionate about what you're doing?
You know, we were talking about it before we got into the recording, the chaos of it all, the constant changing, that every day is different. That's what kept me in initially. But then I figured out that this intersection of tech and legal, where no one has the right path, and then everyone feels like an imposter, everyone is kind of scared and uncertain and doesn't really know what to do. And everyone has a superpower. And for me, it's translating these complicated things into ways legal concepts so techies get it, technical concepts so legal people get it. And by being this hub, I help people. And so for me, my why is I have this superpower that helps people be less terrified when the world's changing. And in fact, now even more so than ever, because everything is changing. How you live, you work, you play is being fundamentally changed by AI. And I happen to be at a company all in on AI. And so I've been able to be out there and speaking. And a lot of what I do, you guys have heard me speak, like I'm not a salesperson. I'm speaking about here's tech and tools and resources, how you think about it, how you problem solve. And it's all about bringing talented and interested people along for the ride when they could be left behind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we've heard you speak and draw parallels between the AI boom and the early days of eDiscovery. So how do you feel like those moments are similar and where do they diverge?
So that feeling of everything's happening so fast and building the plane while we're flying it, doppelganger, totally the same. Like if you think about eDiscovery, it was discovery until 2006, then they just threw the E on, right? There were tendrils of eDiscovery before that, but for the vast majority of firms and legal professionals, it went from, is this email ever going to be discovered, to, oh my gosh, I've got to spend millions of dollars in eDiscovery. So that same transition is happening, but the difference between the eDiscovery, the birth of eDiscovery and early TAR 1.0 and predictive coding and today is we're moving with the AI renaissance at a speed faster than anything before. I think the CISO of Uber said the AI renaissance today, it's not like the printing press. It's not like the advent of the internet. It's not like the advent of the written word. It's like fire because it's changing everything. It's not just changing how you do a task. It's changing how you think, what tools you use, what your job looks like, what your free time looks like. And so while there's parallels of building the plane while it's flying and having to pivot really quickly and having to have elastic problem solving and translation skills, it's that on steroids. And I think we're going to see transitions happening we are seeing it already much, much faster, which means folks like you guys, folks like me that are helping to break down the previous fear of STEM and math and science for the legal community are that much more important. If that kind of makes sense, it's gone through it before, but not quite like this.
Yeah. Well, and there is certainly a lot of talk and a lot of hype, and I see so many webinars about how AI is affecting our profession. But in your opinion, what's one overhyped claim about AI's impact on eDiscovery, and what's one underhyped truth?
So I think the overhyped claim is it's going to take everyone's job, right? But the underhyped truth is it's going to change everyone's job. What you do today is not going to be the same as what you do in 5, 6, 8 months. In terms of like individual point solutions, the generative AI search, generative AI review, that's going to be, more or less important. What I think people are missing, though, is much like in the birth of eDiscovery, there's an opportunity in this changing of how we do our jobs for maybe people who had hit a ceiling or who are new in their career to level up exponentially fast. Mm-hmm. I think of like the paralegal managers. My friend Cheryl Moretti was a paralegal manager, and she was on a case team out of London, and she channeled that into running all the European eDiscovery and became a force within Gibson Dunn when historically you kind of had a ceiling as a paralegal. And so I think for different skill sets, different people, there's an opportunity to rip your seat right up at the table, because every aspect of your job is going to be impacted by AI. And the tools you use, whether it's, you know, exterior tools reveal, yes, but also the business tools you use, how you write an email, how you communicate, how you break down a problem, how you conceive of issues, how you even think is fundamentally changing. And the people that can grab on, hold on, and kind of raise their hand are going to have opportunities they may have never imagined. You know, we're not going to get the $100 million that the engineer making OpenAI when he got poached to Meta got, but maybe you're going to double your salary, right? There's this cool, exciting, terrifying moment, and we're in the middle of it.
Yeah, I love how you're pointing out that this is a good time for people to level up. And I think that, you know, it's not by accident that we all find ourselves here on this call today talking about this. You know, all three of us very much believe in propelling our industry and making it approachable to people that haven't been able to be in our industry in the past. And AI is certainly going to be a door that will facilitate that for many, many people. When we get more granular, because you've already kind of talked about, you know, the types of people that are really rising to the top in terms of the AI race, I guess I'd say. If we want to get more granular, though, what kind of workflows do you think are going to be affected within the next, I don't know, year or 2 years, from a law firm perspective or from an in-house perspective? What do you see on the roadmap?
I mean, I think information retrieval of all kind is going to be fundamentally changed, but not just by generative AI. I think we're going to see agents coming in, which are able to lean on old school machine learning, more advanced AI and Gen AI and do load balancing for you. And so what do I mean by information retrieval? Yes, discovery, all the way up to and including like the reinforcement learning approach to generative AI review, where it's smaller teams working in parallel. But knowledge management, understanding the skills that you have within your organization, case law research, predictive modeling, all of this. And I think what you're going to see is kind of an aggregation. This may be a longer tail thing, but because I've been sort of envisioning it for a while, I think eDiscovery as its own thing is dead, because what we do in eDiscovery is so much bigger than that, right? And so I think it's going to be more unstructured data analysis in all of these different areas. And I think as we expand, whether it's compliance or cyber or employment or whatever, it's all going to kind of blend together, and you're going to start getting these macro tools and agents that can look for evidence, can look for predictive risk, can look for kind of across the whole corpus of data. And I think that we're going to see people moving to that, because at the end of the day, there's only so many companies you can buy and merge and invest in, and there's billions of dollars being pumped into legal tech. And so I think the next vision is going to be kind of that eDiscovery supercharged. Mm-hmm. So it's resurrected as something metamorphosed, you know, changed mm-hmm. into something new and bigger.
Yeah, Angie and I talk a lot about cross collaboration, and I guess that's kind of the fundamental truth that we see. You know, eDiscovery is no longer eDiscovery all by itself standing alone. It's a practice that actually filters over or bleeds over into other areas like compliance or privacy or forensic security and all that.
To lead the charge too. Like when I say eDiscovery is dead, I mean as a second class citizen. I think because we have the experience from 20 years ago of building the plane as it's flying and introducing tech and AI into legal with eDiscovery, we, the people talking and thinking about this, are uniquely positioned to help move the whole business forward. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a leveling up as well as an expanding out, which is for those that can time it right, just a massive opportunity. So sorry to step on your toes, but
like, no, that's
exciting. It's really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's great. And it is very exciting. So, you know, some of us are a little older than others of us, as I roll my eyes in the back of my head. But, you know, there's some hesitation when it comes to AI because you think about the human touch, you know, and it's something I am constantly, and Angie will tell you this too, when we use AI for our podcast, for example, I'm constantly like, why can't just trust it? I have to go back over it, make sure it sounds like it's from my heart. And because I only want to put my heart out there. That's all I want. I want to protect the human piece of who we are, because that's what the most important part is. When it comes to business, we want to protect the human connection between our clients, between our coworkers. We don't want to remove that, because that's where all of the purpose is found at the end of the day. So how do you protect that? And what is your view on keeping the human in the legal AI as we become more integrated in the workplace?
I mean, I have probably a different view than most of the pop culture. I think humans are more important now, right? Scroll on LinkedIn. Every post you're seeing has been touched by AI. Some of them have just been touched by a smart human refining it to make it sound like them, and others have been just copy-pasted. And so what you're going to see is a baseline of a certain level of output because people are relying on AI. But to go above, it's going to require that human touch, human subject matter expertise. And so savvy humans become much more important. Now, if you are a human who chooses to not learn the tech, which is becoming table stakes, you'll fall behind. But I think this is the era of human differentiation, because the tech has raised to such a level, it sort of democratized a lot of baseline stuff. But as humans, I can still tell when ChatGPT wrote something, that damn MDAT, or not this comma, but that, right? but that doesn't mean I don't.
Okay, but I actually write that way.
I do. As a human. But I do all the ellipses.
I love an M dash. I feel very passionately that an M dash is an underrated punctuation mark. Oh, I love it, and I will die on that hill.
I love it, but I've had to quit using it. Well, and also, like, when people started using generative AI to start writing prompts, like, it wanted to say legal eagles a lot. I'm like, I've been saying legal eagles since 2007. Give me that. But I think that, you know, the human... humans can sense the human touch. Like, I'm not even, we're kind of in that uncanny valley of output where you can still tell, right? And I think the differentiation between okay output and great output, between finding evidence and synthesizing it for your case strategy and just getting through all the docs and hoping and praying, that's the human side. And so I think I think we're going to see people indexing more on people, but it may not be as many people. And so that's where the friction will come in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you think about longevity in this space, how could somebody future-proof their career in this environment?
Learn all the AI. Not in the learn to code sort of way, right? In the know the words, know the concepts, be able to talk about it, right? Because much like back when e-discovery happened, who ended up becoming the heads of $80, $90 million practices? The people that raised their hand and knew a few buzzwords about, like, the EDRM. It's sort of the same thing now. And so I think, you know, if you know enough to ask the right questions, if you know enough to know about the tools, that, at least for the near to midterm, that's more than enough. I travel around a lot. I'm on the road like 220 days a year, and we're in the bubble, and it can feel like I'm really behind, right? It feels like I don't know enough. Everyone knows more. They're doing it better, right, faster. No. Universally, unilaterally, whatever you want to say, no. Where we feel like we're behind because we actually are ahead. And so if you're going and attending these webinars, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're talking about AI, you're in a position already to start elevating yourself as someone who knows about AI. So just keep learning. And there's things like OpenAI Academy, free, all these great bite-sized learning modules that are made by the most brilliant people out there about AI. Spend half an hour, take two modules, boom, done. Listen to the webinars, find your tribe of dorks. And I'm dorks with a capital D because I love them, right? That you can ask questions about. But, you know, I saw the change coming about 6 years ago, and that's when I rebranded from just eDiscovery Cat to TechnoCat, because it was bigger than pure eDiscovery. And I think if you just kind of keep looking and keep learning about the new interesting things and know enough of the words of art and the concepts to ask the right questions or ask for help, that's the best way to future-proof your career, because no one's going to know everything. I don't know everything, and all I do is eat, breathe, travel, speak this stuff. But I'm curious. I keep learning about more. Like I was playing around with ChatGPT, I think on December 1st, it was released November 30th. You know, be curious, be out there and, you know, be willing to try it and be uncomfortable while you learn how to do it.
So other than this sense of curiosity and this almost childlike sense of play when it comes to this new stuff, what other skill sets do you think are becoming more and more critical every year?
So what's really interesting is with all this talk about AI and us being at the intersection of law and technology, you would think I'd say, oh, go take a computer science course, go take an LLM course. The secret power, the superpower is something legal professionals already have, being wordsmith, being able to articulate what you want, being able to break down a problem into its component pieces. And so, you know, critical reasoning, strong writing skills, an ability to articulate what you want, those are the superpowers today. It's like if you were taking a law school exam, being able to issue spot and write about it in your little blue book, that's how you get the A. Well, basically, when you're trying to get ChatGPT or one of these large language models to do something, it's sort of the same thing. You break down the problem. All right, I want to write a blog. All right, help me come up with concepts. Help me come up with titles. Help me structure it. Help me break it down. So you break it into pieces and you tell them who you are, who your audience is, what outcome you want. Like all of those things are very much in our legal lexicon. It's not a new skill set. It's actually a superpower most people that went into law have already. And so lean into that. And, you know, I know we're going to talk a little bit about imposter syndrome now, but if you are in legal today and dealing with the type of tech we have now, you should have no imposter syndrome because you have a superpower that the STEM people don't have, the people writing code don't have. You are a master of words, and we are now AI that is driven by words.
That's really a cool perspective to think about. I had not thought about it in those terms, so I love that, and thank you for sharing that. So talking about that imposter syndrome, as people, whether you're in the industry now and you're just thinking, how am I going to survive the next 10, 20 years or whatever, or whether you want to get in the industry and you're like, whoa, everything seems very chaotic. It's always changing. Things are always different. I mean, how do you personally stay grounded? And you have chosen even the most volatile, I don't know if that's the right word, of areas to concentrate in. Yeah, there you go. But how do you stay grounded when everything around you is changing and chaotic?
Well, the blessing and the curse is no one knows any more than I do in general, right? We all are figuring this out in real time together, right? They're much like with the birth of e-discovery, there's not someone who had been around for 20 years longer than me in 2006 that knew e-discovery better than me because we were building it then, right? And so everyone's an imposter, right? There was no path to get to AI-powered law. There was no path to get to e-discovery. We all had different lives beforehand. You know, car sales girl, come on, right? I know someone who was a soap opera star who is now a head of knowledge management. Like we have people that have all these crazy lives, right? And so none of us belong here, but we all have these unique skills. And so what I learned to do is I'm not going to feel like I've got the same chops as a rainmaker and antitrust. But he's as nervous talking about tech to me as I am to talking to him about antitrust, right? And so figure out your area of expertise. Understand that, you know, as long as you're curious and asking smart questions, no one's going to think you're stupid, right? And that we're all figuring it out together because this isn't an established 50, 100-year-old industry. We don't have black letter law going back to Blackacre. We've got our Greenacre. You know, it's all very new. The case laws being, I've got a do like an RSS feed to see the case law being done right now. And so we're all in this together and there's a camaraderie to that. You're not alone. I know we all think we're special and we are, but you're not special in a negative way. We all have the same gaps that we're trying to fill. And, you know, don't go it alone. Know that everyone else has those similar challenges. Stay curious and, you know what you're an expert at. I've talked with some people. I've got a great gal that works on my marketing team, and she's like, well, I was trying to find some speakers. I'm really nervous. I'm like, well, you're the producer. That's the gatekeeper to a bunch of webinars, and all these lawyers want to be on your webinar. You're the expert. Go in and feel confident because you're the expert about getting onto the show. And so kind of if you reframe it to here's my expertise, and I'm sharing it with someone who doesn't know about that, and I'm not way far behind because we're all kind of in the same boat, it suddenly becomes a lot less daunting.
That's great advice.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, we're all sort of building the plane while it's in flight, Nobody's been in this field forever. But what would you give, what advice would you give to someone who's curious about e-discovery and just doesn't quite know where to start?
So there's a ton of resources, like the EDRM's great, ACEDS is great. There's bloggers, like I try to write a lot, which is very ELI 5, explain like I'm 5, so follow me. There's a lot of writers out there, Rob Robinson, Doug Austin, who are constantly writing about this stuff, but also find a dork, find someone who's doing it for a while and ask them, hey, I'll treat you to a coffee, walk me through it. Or, hey, I've got a couple questions. Going back to the imposter syndrome thing, because there was no one right path to get here, we've all gone through it. We all still have that imposter on our shoulder. And because of that, I have found our industry to be so giving and so welcoming and so willing to help someone who wants to help themselves. So if you were to ask me, hey, can you walk me through this? My answer might be, oh, I'm flying today, but how about Tuesday, right? And that's someone on the road 229 days a year. All of us want to help. So look at those organizations, EDRM, ACEDS. Look for the dorks that are writing and posting about it. Listen to podcasts like this where you're going to have experts on there. And then don't be afraid to ask. That's how the reason I really got into LinkedIn like almost 20 years ago wasn't to be a sparkly influencer. I think 23-year-old me with the bad bangs and the ill-fitting gray suit who was afraid of standing out would have at the sequins I wear now. But it was, hey, I can actually talk to these people. And I could talk to someone who maybe wouldn't answer a phone call, but if I had a question, they would. And so we have this democratized access where if you ask, not, hey, buy my stuff, but hey, I'm trying to get in the industry. Do you have any recommendations? 9 times out of 10, people will help you.
Yeah, I found that to be the case as well. But what, like, are there any sort of lesser known access points to the industry that people should maybe be aware of?
There's the regional groups like Women in eDiscovery. There's, frankly, my company, Bree's company, the Big Orange company, all have very robust training programs and academies. A lot of times, like the certification might have a cost, but usually the training is free. There's YouTube channels. And like I said, ACEDS is a pretty good one. EDRM is pretty good for like just that basic organizational stuff. I know they have different courses. Webinars, I mean, there's a webinar every 35 seconds, it feels like. And ask around, like, don't be shy. If you're in a region that maybe isn't super serviced by ACEDS, I don't know, whatever, ask peers, ask people that are in the area, or if it's an area that desperately needs e-discovery training, hit me up. I've flown out to Indianapolis and up Minnesota, whatever, before just to train people on stuff. Like, if there's a gap, raise your hand, and you might be surprised. People might do a lot, move mountains to try to help.
Yeah, I think it's like a really, and Angie and I have talked about this before. And in fact, when we got together to do this podcast originally, we talked about it, how giving this industry is. And, you'll hear Kat talking about her company. You'll hear me talking about my company. We don't work for the same company. In fact, we work for competing companies, but we all get together and we all want to share and nerd out or dork out, whatever your terminology is, to help each other grow, because there's room at the table for everyone. And I love that about e-discovery industry. When we're talking about the new generation of e-discovery and all the people that are going to kind of come into our space that have never had the opportunity to be here before because of, generally speaking, AI likely would be the driving force here. What excites you the most about this new wave of professionals coming into e-discovery or legal tech in general?
Well, I think the cool thing for them is there's 20 years of proving what we do matters, right? Early on, like the competitor to our companies in 06 was doing nothing, was pretending that you didn't send the email, right? And so we really had to, like, these were big dollars, big complexity cases. And so we had to not just pull a seat up at the table, but prove we should even be in the room. And so for the people coming in now, like, e-discovery is a known thing, cyber is a known thing. What we do, there's a baseline of knowing it's important. Maybe not as respected as a rainmaker. That's never going to happen in a law firm. But we've already got some credibility. And so for them, it's not as steep of an uphill. The other thing that's really interesting is this is the first time ever that during an industrial revolution, AI revolution, legal's been not just an early mover, but tip of the spear. We really are moving the needle on things that are shaping legislation. I was working with the New York Bar, State Bar Association, on a report that, you know, we gave to a bunch of regulators that they used for regulation on AI. So legal is impactful. Legal tech has a unique skill set about understanding transformation with technology. And we've been using AI for 20 years and we're credible. So there's this really interesting place we're in where there's a little bit of respect, but there's also a little bit of room to kind of kick that door open and, you know, move the table to you, which here 7-8 years ago. And I don't foresee it going away because we're not going to let it.
Mm-hmm. I love that concept of moving the table to you.
Well, because where we're supposed to be.
Yeah.
Like, the way we've been doing legal stuff isn't sustainable, right? And so there is a lot of moving towards us. And you know, there is compromise too, but it's not just, hey, sneaking in and like hoping that the rainmaker partner doesn't get mad at us and say, I'm not billing for you. Go away. Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that you are known for, Kat, is your brand. I mean, anybody anywhere that sees that techno cat in the background that's in our industry knows exactly who it belongs to. And I can say, even being at a place like Legal Week this year, I remember making a comment to my colleague. I swear Kat walks into the room and it's like this wave of energy and people, and it's just kind of like all goes around her like she's Marilyn Monroe, and then she she lights up the whole room and then she's gone. It's like, wow, what just happened? So your brand. So Angie, I know that you were going to get us started on some questions regarding Kat's brand. So I'll let you dive in.
It's not quite normal when you think of lawyers and tech, I know.
No, but it's so important. I mean, the way I think about it, every practitioner sort of needs to be a salesperson for themselves. And so the need to brand yourself is super important. So, you know, you, like Bree said, have one of the most recognizable brands in legal tech industry. And so was that intentional? Did it evolve organically, or was it somewhere in between?
So it started out, I think I mentioned it earlier, being that awkward, bad bangs, gray suit, afraid to stand up. Out in the space, I felt like such an imposter. I'm not someone that went coding. I'm not someone that went right from practice in here. I don't belong. Let me try to just blend in. Let me try to not stand out. And what I realized is, as I aimed for the people who were effectively haters, people who weren't going to like me, I was shrinking myself and turning myself into someone I didn't like. And I wasn't visible to the type of people who would like me. And so it was creating this bad feedback loop. And so I maybe at 25, 26, I just was like, well, screw it. If someone's not going to like me, they're not going to like me in a burlap sack. I'm going to wear what I want. And I just started doing it a little bit, like the hot pink under the black or the gray suit, and bit by bit. And then as I started writing and speaking, it just started resonating. It was disarming for people. And then I started having people come up and say, hey, you know, I was nervous to wear these shoes, but I wore them for you. Or, hey, you know, I was, you know, nervous to not wear the skirt suit because it was a lot of misogyny. Like I started in Texas. So I had to wear the nylons, the 2.5-inch peep toes, the skirt suit down below your knee, like, and not fitted because I'm a little curvy. Right. So it was like, it went from that to, well, I'm, you know, unapologetically feminine. I'm unapologetically big and loud, and I'm just going to lean into it. And as that kind of became what I'm known for kind of looks wise and, you know, just being out there and visible, it sort of became my armor. Like, and when I'm going to go and be on, like, even though I'm not on camera, I'm wearing this because I feel more on when I've got my armor on. It's my superhero costume, right? But then the brand kind of developed around it. And so if anyone wants to go to the eDiscover, I think it's just eDiscoveryCat.com. It's a very law firm-esque, blues and grays, very mild-mannered. And then when I went to the TechnoCat, I have a giant neon pink cat and my colors are pink and teal and neon because I just realized it feels inauthentic if I'm not Cat, who I am on the inside, when I'm out there with people, especially if I'm on the road so much. And so my brand can't be different, so different, because it feels like I'm lying to you, right? Mm-hmm. So it was more about kind of quit aiming for the haters and aim for the raving fans. And then as I did that, I kind of came more into myself. And as I came more into myself, I was like, well, my brand needs to reflect that. And then I just started getting really positive feedback from people that were like, hey, I was afraid to, you know, wear cool, funky glasses, or I was afraid to wear something sparkly, or I was, you know, I didn't feel like it was professional to do that. And so I kind of have taken it as like another mission to say, you know, looking a certain way doesn't mean you can't be a badass, right? And so It sort of became like part my armor and part my mission.
I love that. When I was like a little, you know, a baby lawyer and associate at a law firm, I very much felt like, oh, I can only wear specific things. I didn't even want to wear an Apple Watch, for crying out loud, because I was like, oh, it's not professional enough, blah, blah, blah. And now I'm like, here I am a decade into my career with fewer fucks to give about that kind of thing. And then on the other side of the pandemic as well, I feel like the pandemic really softened a lot of those really rigorous, rigid dress codes. But now I'm like, oh, I've always got like wacky, wild nails. Like, I'll wear silver leather pants sometimes with like a blazer and call it good. Like, it's this kind of unlocking that feels really empowering.
It feels great to just be you, you know?
Yeah.
And it's for me, it's sort of like I don't remember who did the TED talk, but like do the Superwoman pose or whatever, if you want to feel confident. I put on the Superwoman outfit, right? And it does help with decision fatigue, because what am I going to wear? Sparkles and chaos. Done.
I love that.
Also, I've noticed if you're dressed like a disco ball and people come up to you, they have self-selected into who you are, right? If they're going to judge you, they're going to judge you from afar. If they're coming and talking to you, you've already kind of broken the ice or something to talk about. And from across the room, you see me, you know, it's me, right? And so it makes me more approachable and lets people self-select out. So I'm, you know, if you're going to be a hater, then you can be a hater from afar.
Then unsubscribe. Mm-hmm. Fine. So if somebody was going to start building a brand that aligned with who they are and what they care about, what advice would you give them?
So I kind of look at three pillars, right? What's your why? Like for me, I want to make this scary transition less scary. I want to educate people, right? So have a core why and ground everything. You know, have, you know, core things that are unique to you, like your values, right? For me, authenticity and honesty and transparency, those are things that are like core. Those are like in what is it, Inside Out, those are like core memories. Those are the core and then what you want to do. So your why, your who, and your what. And be crystal clear on those and revisit them. I go through my friend Maribel Rivera, who another scion who's out there. She's got a whole branding workbook that even me, I go through and I course correct, because I have done. I did a big ass rebrand 6 years ago to change, to be more authentic and for what I wanted to do and to embrace like the future, because I want to do more AI. And I keep myself honest that way. So if you have those three anchors and you make sure everything you're doing leads into that, it's powerful. And I'll give you an example of like, sometimes I've had to course correct. Like I tore my Achilles tendon 48%, not quite 50. 50 means surgery. 48 means stem cells and lasers and all this other shit. And so I took a picture of my foot after getting stem cells with like a robot attached to it. I'm like, this is so cool. And I posted it and I got 175,000 views and like 10,000 likes.
Oh my God.
Now, if my why was more visibility, you would see my feet a whole heck of a lot more. But I realized, like, that's cool. It strokes my ego, but it doesn't align with my why. So I was like, even though that does give me visibility, my why is to educate people. And my feet, while very foot-like, are not very didactic. They're not teaching a whole lot. And so, like, it's those anchors kind of help you, as you're building something, not drift too far away from your core. Or if those three things have changed, then you can be unafraid to make a pivot in your brand and then just have authenticity kind of run throughout. Like if you are bookish and quiet and professorial, if you're George Socha, don't try to be Kat, right? And George and I work at the same company. It's not a critique. Like, we have very different approaches. George and Sparkles might make people raise an eyebrow. Me, dressed like George with the glasses, being quiet and professorial, would also cause a lot of eyebrow. So like, be off, like, give yourself like a candid assessment of who you are, who you want to be, what you want to do, and be realistic, because you might be kind of introverted and want to be more outspoken. You can do baby steps, but I wouldn't say, hey, put on the sparkles and throw yourself on stage day one, because you'll hate it and it won't work. So.
Mm-hmm. And sparkles aren't for everyone. I don't think I could pull them off like you can. So, you know, you talked to some about your rebrand and that you kind of took a career shift. Because I think about rebranding and I'm like, oh God, I've become something I don't like, or I've made mistakes, or I really want to reinvent myself to, you know, appreciate the good about me and let go of the baggage that I have. Like, those are the kind of reasons why I could see or why I'm rebranding. Or maybe I've decided, like I did, I worked 15 years as a paralegal and then I went and did e-discovery. What happens and what advice would you give, I guess, would be the better question, to somebody who's contemplating this? Is it time for me to rebrand? How do I go about that and not look like a big fat phony where all of a sudden one day I'm wearing black and the next day I'm wearing, you know, blingy pink cinquids? You know, like how do I stay true to myself and go about this?
I mean, I think step one is before the outward facing, the inward, like, why don't I like this aspect of it? What about this is bothering me? And like, kind of get down to that deeper level of, you know, does it feel inauthentic? Is it not my aspiration career wise? And really drill that down. Like, because what you need to do is, I think a lot of us have brands that evolve despite us, not with us driving it. And so, a rebrand is an awesome time. And that's why you'll notice, like, up till 5 or 6 years ago, I was still out there. I was still sparkly, but it was a little chaotic and it became a lot more organized. A rebrand is an opportunity to really look at all the moving pieces and look at what will make you happy with this and what will achieve what you want, and then be thoughtful about it. Because like, I spent a couple months, I did it all myself. I did it all like GoDaddy and WordPress, nothing fancy. You didn't need to be crazy. But I really drilled down, like, what do I want to do? What's going to make me happy? And, you know, part of it was I was unhappy. Like, I didn't want to only be pigeonholed into only talking about e-discovery stuff, not because e-discovery is not sexy, but because there was more going on around. And I didn't want the law firm looking website because that didn't match with who I was. And I didn't want long form white paper caliber writing that was off-putting because my goal was to help elevate from the baby paralegal on up. And so I looked at the levers that I had and I made the changes to achieve what I wanted. So I wanted to be accessible. I wanted to be bright and welcoming. I wanted to be a lower barrier of entry. And so I pivoted that way. But the why was I felt stuffy and stifled. So I had to get that next level deeper to understand what was bugging me. And it's not a fun experience to be like, what did I fuck up and how do I fix it?
I've never felt that way before.
yeah.
Fix out. Like, and to see it working. Like, I have to tell you, like, that's been awesome. Like, just even the way people react to me today, like, I got that great Trailblazer Award. I wouldn't have gotten that 5 years ago. And I had 15 years of doing the same thing. But the things I was doing wasn't aligned with who I was, and people didn't really know me as well. And so rebranding actually helped bring people along for the ride with me. Mm-hmm. So it brought them in. And I think it requires a little vulnerability and a little trust that when you bring people in, they aren't going to hurt you. And they might, but, you know, less hurt, more help is the name of the game.
Yeah. I mean, that is a real fear, what you just said. And I've thought about it too in doing the podcast. You know, what if I put myself out there and then somebody attacks me or I get hurt or, you know, something from my past comes back that I don't want to have to deal with all over again, whatever the case may be. And, you know, I think that being brave enough to push through that says a lot about your character, and it says a lot about your own personal passion and proves up your why, you know, why you're doing this in the first place. So I appreciate the fact that you made those choices to move past that. And, you know, I'll have to say, Kat, when I first started following you on LinkedIn and saw your brand, I was like, this girl is so girly and just like beautiful, of course. I cannot relate to her at all. Like, I am such a cynic. I am not blingy girly. Like, I don't think we could ever be friends. But the more that I get to know you, the more that I listen to you, and the more I get to talk to you, I just appreciate so much your heart and that you are willing to be your true self. And I think that for our flock out there that's listening, that's a good takeaway. You know, who I am and who Angie is and who Kat is are three completely different women from three to totally different backgrounds and perspectives. But all of us have the willingness to just be ourselves. And that is the most effective way to touch people for the better, I think. So I appreciate you sharing all of that insight. Angie, I know we're about to close up, so I wanted to see if you had anything additional you might want to say or ask Kat about before we call it a day.
I think we've covered pretty much everything. Kat, is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to make sure we work in?
No, I mean, the only thing I would tell to your audience is if they're not following me, follow me, and don't be shy about reaching out. Like, none of us got where we are without having people help us along the way. And, you know, I always want to be a resource.
Yeah. So if people wanted to reach out to you, Kat, why don't you explain to our flock how they would do that?
So I've got my website, thetechnocat.com. I don't do a ton with it, so other than repost stuff. Otherwise, LinkedIn. It will be my face with a hot pink background. No matter what I change my face to, if it's a new picture, it's always a hot pink background. It should say Kat, the Technocat, Casey, and I'm at Reveal. I try to share as much as I can about stuff I write, different speaking, different case law, everything going on, and point people in the right direction for other people to talk to. The biggest advice for everyone tuning in is you shouldn't and don't have to go it alone. Build up your tribe, because that is the only reason all of us have stayed in the industry for as long as we have, because it's kind of a badass tribe.
I agree with that.
All right. That is all the time we have, folks. Thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. Don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website at eDiscoveryChicks.com. Anyone who doesn't already should also go ahead and connect with Kat on LinkedIn or go to her website, thetechnocat.com. If you loved this episode, please share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on your socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. This podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery and legal tech principles, and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It is not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you've retained and who has agreed to represent you. Bye.
Incredible.
Love it. This is fun.